A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a follow-up of sorts. We previously talked about his taste in comedy. Nathan, for you, Trigger Happy TV, Dom Jolly's work. And apparently we did a decent job psychoanalyzing him, because he's back with more data. He's adding Waiting for Godot, Vanilla Sky, The Matrix, Inception, but he doesn't love all of these. He can't get into Severance. He doesn't like sci-fi. So he's asking, what's the through line here? If we had to wrap this into one defined genre or subgenre, what would we call it? And then, given that expanded fingerprint, what else might he enjoy? Not just film and TV, but podcasts, writers, thinkers, philosophers. So we're building a taste profile and then recommending across media.
I love this. We're essentially doing cultural matchmaking based on a psychological fingerprint, and the fingerprint has gotten richer since last time.
Last time, we landed on creating absurd social situations and watching how society reacts as comedy. That was the core mechanism. But now we've got plays about waiting for someone who never arrives, movies about simulated realities and implanted memories, and a specific aversion to both sci-fi and Severance. That's actually more revealing than the inclusions.
The Severance thing is the key that unlocks this. Because on paper, Severance should be perfect for someone who likes The Matrix and Inception and absurdist explorations of authority. It's literally about people who sever their work and personal memories, creating two versions of themselves trapped in a corporate labyrinth. But it's also deeply science fictional in its premise, and it's about institutional control from the inside. I think what's being rejected there isn't the premise, it's the aesthetic and the emotional register.
Say more about the emotional register.
Severance is cold. It's sterile. Those endless white corridors, the flat affect, the Lumon building that looks like a corporate mausoleum. Even the humor is deadpan to the point of hypothermia. Compare that to Vanilla Sky, which is lush and romantic and unhinged. Or The Matrix, which has leather trench coats and rooftop shootouts and Keanu Reeves discovering he's the chosen one. Or Inception, where the emotional core is literally a man trying to get home to his children. These are all high-emotion, high-stakes stories wrapped in philosophical puzzles. Severance is a philosophical puzzle wrapped in beige.
That's it exactly. The Severance aesthetic is the visual equivalent of an HR onboarding video that slowly reveals itself to be a hostage situation. And for someone whose taste runs toward the warm-blooded and the emotionally direct, that registers as off-putting, even if the ideas align.
The sci-fi aversion. I don't think it's an aversion to speculative ideas. It's an aversion to a specific set of genre signifiers. Spaceships, aliens, distant futures, technobabble. But The Matrix is sci-fi. Inception is sci-fi. They just don't present themselves that way aesthetically. They feel like thrillers, like psychological dramas, like heist films.
We're not dealing with someone who dislikes speculative fiction. We're dealing with someone who dislikes the furniture of speculative fiction, the blinking lights, the actors in prosthetic foreheads discussing warp drives. He wants the ideas without the cosplay.
Which brings us to the through line. What do you call this?
I've been thinking about this. The term that keeps coming back is absurdist realism. Or maybe social surrealism. Something that acknowledges the fundamental weirdness of ordinary life without leaving it behind entirely.
I'd push back slightly on realism because these works aren't realistic in any conventional sense. A man falls asleep and wakes up in a lucid dream where his dead lover is alive and his face is disfigured. That's not realism. But I take your point. It's grounded in emotional truth and recognizable social dynamics even when the premise is impossible.
The absurdity emerges from real social situations pushed slightly past their breaking point. Nathan, for you, isn't absurd because Nathan Fielder is a cartoon character. It's absurd because he's dead serious, and the situations are just one degree removed from actual business proposals. Tom Jolly dressed as a giant snail in a public park isn't absurd in a fantastical way. It's absurd in a this-should-not-be-happening-in-a-public-park way.
The through line across all of these is the collision between a constructed reality and the social norms that reality violates. In Waiting for Godot, two men wait endlessly for someone who will never come, and they fill the time with vaudeville routines and circular conversations. The absurdity is that they're performing normal social behavior, waiting politely, making conversation, in a situation where those behaviors are completely unmoored from meaning.
The comedy comes from watching them try to make it make sense. That's the Nathan for you mechanism exactly. Nathan proposes something insane with a straight face. The business owner tries to process it using normal social scripts, and the gap between the proposal and the processing is where the comedy lives.
In Vanilla Sky, Tom Cruise's character is living in a lucid dream that gradually becomes a nightmare, and the horror comes from his inability to distinguish the simulation from reality. But the emotional engine is still a love story. He's not trying to hack the mainframe, he's trying to figure out whether the woman he loves is real.
That's the second dimension of this taste profile. It's not just absurdist social exploration, it's absurdist social exploration with a romantic or emotional core. These works all have a heartbeat. They're not clinical thought experiments. They're puzzles with people inside them.
If I had to name this genre, I'd call it warm absurdism, or perhaps absurdism with a human face. It's the tradition that runs from Gogol to Ionesco to Charlie Kaufman, work that uses surreal or impossible premises to explore deeply human longings, but does it with a certain warmth and humor rather than cold intellectual distance.
Gogol is a good pull. The nose is exactly this. A man wakes up to find his nose has left his face and is now living its own life as a government official. The premise is absurd, but the story is played completely straight, and the comedy comes from watching society try to accommodate this impossible thing.
The authority dimension. This is the third thread. Almost every work mentioned involves a confrontation with authority or institutional power that turns out to be arbitrary, unreliable, or actively deceptive. In The Matrix, the authority is the machines who built a simulation to farm humans. In Inception, it's the architecture of the mind itself, but also the corporate power that hired Cobb. In Nathan for You, it's the entire apparatus of commerce and regulation that Nathan exploits. In Waiting for Godot, Godot himself is the absent authority, never seen, never explained, but obeyed anyway.
The trust in authority question runs through all of it. These are works that say, essentially, the people in charge may not exist, may be lying to you, or may be making it up as they go along. And the appropriate response to that realization isn't despair, it's curiosity. Sometimes it's comedy.
That's what distinguishes this from dystopian fiction. Dystopias are about what happens when authority is malevolent and competent. This taste profile is about what happens when authority is arbitrary and possibly imaginary. It's less 1984, more The Trial. Less V for Vendetta, more Brazil.
Brazil is actually a perfect reference point that wasn't mentioned. It's got the absurdist bureaucracy, the romantic core, the dream sequences bleeding into reality. If someone likes all the words we're discussing, Brazil is almost certainly in their sweet spot.
It's interesting that Severance doesn't work for this person. Because Severance is basically Brazil without the warmth, without the romanticism, without the jazz. It's the same critique of corporate authority, but delivered in a minor key with all the color drained out.
Let's land this. The genre, if we're naming it, and I think warm absurdism is close, but maybe too cuddly sounding. I'd go with absurdist humanism. The world is fundamentally strange and possibly a simulation, and the people in charge don't know what they're doing. But human connection and genuine emotions still matter, and the whole thing is funnier than it is frightening.
I'll endorse that. And it connects directly back to the comedy distinction we made last time. This isn't cruel comedy, it isn't punching down, it isn't YouTube prank channels where the joke is that someone got humiliated. The joke is that the situation is impossible and we're all in it together.
The distinction between look at this fool and look at this situation we're all stuck in. One is sadism, the other is recognition.
Recognition is the foundation of the best absurdist work. You're not laughing at the person. You're laughing at the truth of the predicament, which you recognize because you've been in versions of it yourself.
So we've named the genre. Now the fun part, what else fits?
Can I go wide on this? because the prompt specifically opened it up beyond film and television.
Build the cannon.
Let's start with the obvious adjacent filmmaker, Charlie Kaufman. If this person hasn't seen Synecdoche, New York, it's almost certainly going to land. It's about a theater director who builds a life-size replica of New York City inside a warehouse to stage a play about his own life, and the replica keeps expanding until it contains replicas within replicas. It's absurdist. It's humanist. It's emotionally devastating, and it's fundamentally about the impossibility of capturing reality in art.
Being John Malkovich. A portal into the mind of John Malkovich, discovered by a puppeteer, exploited for profit. That's absurdist social exploration in its purest form. The premise is impossible, but the human reactions, jealousy, greed, longing, are completely real.
Kaufman wrote Being John Malkovich, but didn't direct it. Spike Jonze did. But that collaborative pairing produced exactly the kind of work we're describing. Adaptation, which they also did together, is a movie about a screenwriter trying to adapt a book about orchids, and he writes himself into the script, and then his fictional twin brother takes over. It's a Russian nesting doll of reality and fiction.
The fictional twin brother got an Oscar nomination. That's not a joke. Donald Kaufman is a real credited screenwriter who doesn't exist. That's the level of reality bending we're dealing with.
It's funny. That's the thing. Kaufman's work is often described as cerebral or philosophical, but it's also genuinely funny. The comedy comes from the absurdity of the situations and the very human ways people respond to them.
Moving beyond film, in literature, the direct ancestor here is probably Jorge Luis Borges. His short stories are essentially thought experiments about reality, identity, and authority, compressed into 5 or 10 pages. The Library of Babel imagines a universe that is an infinite library containing every possible book. Pierre Menard, author of The Quixote, is about a man who rewrites Don Quixote word for word, not by copying it, but by arriving at it independently through his own experience, and Borges argues it's a completely different work because of the context.
Borges is a great call. And Italo Calvino. If on a winter's night a traveler is a novel about you, the reader trying to read a novel called If on a Winter's Night a Traveler, and every chapter is the beginning of a different book. It's playful, it's structurally absurd, but it's also a love letter to reading and to the relationship between reader and text.
Calvino's Invisible Cities is Marco Polo describing impossible cities to Kublai Khan, each one a kind of philosophical puzzle. But the emotional core is the conversation between the two men, the aging emperor and the young explorer, and the melancholy awareness that all cities are ultimately one city, all descriptions are ultimately self-descriptions.
In theater, beyond Beckett, Tom Stoppard. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, takes two minor characters from Hamlet and puts them center stage, but they have no idea what's happening in the main plot. They're waiting, they're confused, they're trying to make sense of fragmentary information. It's Waiting for Godot meets Shakespeare, and it's hilarious.
Arcadia, which jumps between the early 19th century and the present day in the same English country house, with characters in both timelines investigating the same mysteries and getting things partly right and partly wrong. The authority being questioned here is academic certainty, the idea that we can ever fully know the past.
Which connects to something I want to flag, a lot of this work is about the incompleteness of knowledge. The characters in these stories are trying to understand their situation, and they're making progress, but they never quite get there. Godot never arrives. Cobb may or may not be still dreaming. The nose never fully explains itself.
That's the epistemological modesty at the heart of absurdist humanism. The world is too strange to fully comprehend, but the attempt to comprehend it is meaningful anyway.
Let me jump to a more contemporary recommendation, the podcast Welcome to Night Vale. It's presented as a community radio show for a fictional desert town where every conspiracy theory is true. The local dog park is forbidden. Do not enter the dog park. The city council is a vague but menacing government agency. There's a glow cloud that drops dead animals on the town. But it's delivered in the warm, soothing tones of a public radio host. And the emotional core is the relationship between the host, Cecil, and his scientist boyfriend, Carlos.
That's a perfect fit. The aesthetic is cozy horror, but the mechanism is exactly what we're describing. An absurd, constructed reality presented straight, with genuine human warmth underneath.
In film, I'd add The Truman Show. It's almost too on the nose. A man whose entire life is a constructed reality TV show, and he's the only one who doesn't know. But it earns its place because the emotional stakes are real. He's not just escaping a simulation, he's losing his entire world, including people he loved. The final scene, with the boat hitting the sky, is one of the great existential moments in cinema.
It predates The Matrix by a year. 1998 versus 1999. Those two films arriving back to back really kicked off a wave of reality questioning mainstream cinema that we're still riding.
The Matrix took the philosophical idea and made it an action movie. The Truman Show took the same idea and made it a human drama. Both are valid, and both fit this taste profile.
Let me throw in a thinker. The philosopher who maps most directly onto this sensibility is probably Albert Camus, but specifically the Camus of The Myth of Sisyphus, not the Camus of The Stranger. The essay opens with the famous line about the only serious philosophical problem being suicide, which sounds grim, but the argument is actually life-affirming. Sisyphus pushes his boulder up the hill forever. The gods have condemned him to meaningless labor, and Camus concludes that we must imagine Sisyphus happy. The absurdity of existence is acknowledged, but the response is not despair. It's revolt, freedom, and passion.
Camus was famously handsome and wore trench coats and smoked constantly, which I mention only because there's a certain aesthetic dimension to absurdist humanism that shouldn't be overlooked. It's not just the ideas, it's the style. The Matrix has style. Vanilla Sky has style. Even Waiting for Godot, for all its minimalism, has a kind of ragged, tramp chic style.
The aesthetic matters because these works are making a case that absurdity isn't drab. It's vivid. It's worth dressing up for. Severance is drab absurdity. That's the distinction.
Another philosopher who fits is Jean Baudrillard, specifically Simulacra and Simulation. He argued that in the modern world, copies have replaced originals, and we're living in a simulation of reality that's more real to us than reality itself. The Matrix literally shows Neo using a hollowed-out copy of Simulacra in Simulation to hide his contraband. That's not subtle. But Baudrillard himself is worth reading because he's playful in a way that academic philosophers often aren't. He writes in aphorisms and provocations.
Baudrillard also famously said that the Gulf War did not take place. Not literally. He argued that the war as experienced by the global public was so mediated, so pre-scripted, so constructed for television, that it was more simulation than event. He was being deliberately provocative, but the provocation is itself an absurdist gesture. It's a Nathan, for you move in philosophical form.
That's a wild comparison, but I see it. The deadpan delivery of an insane proposition to see how the system reacts.
Let me pivot to something more contemporary and less canonical, the YouTube channel, How To with John Wilson. Have you seen this?
Oh, this is perfect. For listeners who don't know, John Wilson is a filmmaker in New York who makes these documentary episodes that start with a practical how-to premise, like how to make small talk, or how to cover your furniture, and then spiral into these strange, tender, hilarious explorations of New York life. He interviews random people, captures bizarre street scenes, and somehow finds profound meaning in the most mundane things.
The episode about scaffolding. He starts out trying to understand why New York is always covered in scaffolding, and by the end, he's meditating on protection, risk, and the impossibility of truly safeguarding yourself from life. It's absurdist humanism in documentary form.
The humor is never cruel. He films odd people, but he's not mocking them. He's curious about them. There's a generosity to the gaze. That's the Nathan for You distinction we made. The difference between prank channels that humiliate and work that explores absurdity with genuine curiosity.
John Wilson's predecessor in this mode is probably Ross McElwee, the documentary filmmaker. His film Sherman's March is normally about retracing General Sherman's Civil War campaign through the South. But it actually becomes about McElwee's romantic life, his family, his neuroses, and the impossibility of sticking to a plan. The camera is supposed to be on history, but it keeps turning back to the filmmaker's own absurd predicament.
Speaking of filmmakers who turn the camera on their own absurd predicament, have we mentioned Woody Allen yet? Specifically, the middle period films like The Purple Rose of Cairo, where a character literally steps out of a movie screen and into the real world, and the actor who played him has to come to town to try to get him back.
I was avoiding Woody Allen for obvious reasons, but The Purple Rose of Cairo is almost too on point to skip. A woman in the Depression era escapes her bleak life by going to the movies, and one day, the character on screen notices her in the audience and walks out of the film. The other characters in the movie are left standing around waiting for him to come back, and eventually, the actor who played the character shows up to manage the situation. It's about the relationship between reality and fiction, the comfort of constructed worlds, and the ache of real life. It's absurdist humanism in its purest form.
It's warm, that's the thing. For all the interpersonal complications around the film itself has a genuine tenderness for its characters.
Let's go back to literature for a moment. He writes short stories that are often set in slightly warped versions of contemporary America. Theme parks, corporate offices, experimental prisons, and the language is a kind of degraded commercial speak that the characters inhabit without quite realizing how strange it is. But the emotional core is always deeply human. People trying to be good in systems that make goodness difficult.
His novel Lincoln and the Bardo is about Abraham Lincoln grieving his dead son, and it's narrated by a chorus of ghosts who don't realize they're dead. It's wildly experimental in form, but the emotional engine is parental grief. That's the absurdist humanist move, radical formal experimentation in service of the most basic human emotions.
It's funny. The ghosts bicker. They have petty rivalries. They're stuck in their own hang-ups, even in the afterlife. The comedy doesn't stop just because the premise is supernatural.
Let me go further afield. The Japanese author Haruki Murakami. This might be a divisive recommendation because Murakami has his own very specific set of tics, jazz, cats, mysterious women, parallel worlds, but the core mechanism is often the same. Ordinary people encounter something impossible, and they respond with a kind of bemused acceptance. The Wyandotte Bird Chronicle starts with a man looking for his missing cat and spirals into a metaphysical war being fought in the subconscious.
Murakami is interesting here because he's adjacent to sci-fi but refuses the genre's conventions. His parallel worlds aren't explained by technology. They just are. A man sits at the bottom of a well and enters another reality. There's no machine, no portal gun, no explanation. It's treated as a fact of existence, and the characters accept it with the same matter-of-factness they'd accept a rainy Tuesday.
That refusal to explain is actually central to this whole tradition. The Matrix explains the simulation. It's machines farming humans. Inception explains the dream-sharing technology. But Waiting for Godot never explains who Godot is or why they're waiting. Nathan for You never breaks character to explain that it's a comedy show. The absurdity is presented without a footnote.
That's the difference between this and traditional sci-fi. Sci-fi wants to build a coherent world. Absurdist humanism wants to present an incoherent world and watch people cope.
Which brings me to a recommendation I think might be divisive. The British show The Prisoner. It's from the 1960s, starring Patrick McGoohan as a former spy who's trapped in a mysterious village where everyone is known by a number. Every episode he tries to escape, and every episode he fails. The authority figures, whoever they are, use psychological manipulation, surreal scenarios, and a giant white balloon named Rover that suffocates people who try to leave.
The Prisoner is a fascinating call because it's the bridge between Kafka and The Truman Show. The village is a panopticon disguised as a resort. The aesthetic is swinging 60s mod, but the underlying premise is pure absurdist nightmare. And the final episode is famously incomprehensible. It's a musical number, a trial, a shootout, and an unmasking that reveals nothing.
The final episode caused such an uproar that McGoohan had to go into hiding. People were furious that he didn't explain everything. But that's the point. The authority being questioned is the audience's expectation of tidy resolution.
That's a through line in almost everything we're describing. These works resist closure. The Matrix sequels are famously messy. Inception's final shot is a spinning top that may or may not fall. Vanilla Sky ends with a choice between dream and reality that leaves the actual outcome ambiguous. Waiting for Godot ends with the characters saying, "Let's go," and not moving.
The refusal of closure is an act of epistemological honesty. The world doesn't resolve neatly. Why should stories?
Let me add another philosophical voice, the American thinker, Richard Rorty. He's not an absurdist in the literary sense, But his pragmatist philosophy argues that truth is made rather than found, that our vocabularies are contingent, and that the goal of philosophy isn't to mirror reality, but to expand our capacity for empathy and solidarity. He's an anti-authoritarian thinker who's also deeply humanistic and often quite funny.
Rorty is a good poll because he connects the philosophical concerns to the political ones without being heavy-handed. His argument is essentially that we should stop trying to ground our beliefs in some ultimate reality, God, reason, nature, and instead focus on reducing cruelty and expanding the circle of human sympathy. It's absurdist in its rejection of final foundations, but humanist in its commitments.
His prose is warm. He writes like a person, not a philosopher. That matters for this taste profile. The mode of expression is part of the content.
In the podcast space, Beyond Night Vale, Paige Gules, Heavyweight. It's a show where Jonathan Goldstein helps people resolve unresolved moments from their past, a borrowed CD that was never returned, a childhood slight that still stings. And he approaches these with incredible seriousness and investigative rigor, which makes the mundane stakes absurd, which makes them profound. It's the Nathan for You mechanism applied to emotional closure.
Goldstein's delivery is key. He's deadpan, almost mournful, but the situations are often ridiculous. He once devoted an entire episode to tracking down a man who loaned him a VHS tape in the 1980s. The tape was Crocodile Dundee. The quest involved private investigators and cross-country travel. It's absurd. It's human. It's deeply funny.
It's never cruel. Goldstein is the butt of his own jokes as often as anyone else. The self-awareness is built in.
In visual art, I'd point to the French artist Sophie Calle. She does these conceptual projects where she creates absurd social situations and documents what happens. She once followed a stranger to Venice and documented his movements without his knowledge. She got a job as a chambermaid in a hotel and photographed the guests' belongings. She asked strangers to sleep in her bed and recorded their experiences. It's performance art, a social experiment, but with a deeply personal, often romantic dimension.
That's an incredible recommendation. Callie's work is essentially Nathan for You if Nathan's goal was to understand love and loss instead of to sell poo-flavored frozen yogurt. The mechanism is the same. Construct an absurd premise, execute it with total seriousness, and the art emerges from the gap between the premise and reality.
The poo-flavored frozen yogurt was a real Nathan for You bit, for listeners who think I'm making that up. He created a flavor that literally tasted like feces and marketed it as a novelty. People bought it. That's the thesis statement of the show. People will accommodate almost anything if it's presented with sufficient confidence.
Which is also the thesis statement of much of human civilization.
You walked into that.
Let me offer one more literary recommendation. The Portuguese writer Fernando Pessoa, specifically The Book of Disquiet. Pessoa wrote under dozens of heteronyms, not pseudonyms, but fully developed alternative identities with their own biographies, writing styles, and philosophical positions. The Book of Disquiet is attributed to one of these heteronyms, Bernardo Soares, an assistant bookkeeper in Lisbon who spends his life observing the city and meditating on existence. It's a fragmented, incomplete work. Pessoa left it in a trunk, and it's essentially a diary of a fictional person.
That's almost too perfect. An author who created dozens of alternate selves left his masterpiece unfinished in a trunk, and the work itself is about the impossibility of being a coherent self. That's absurdist humanism as lifestyle.
The prose is beautiful. Soares watches the rain, walks the same streets, eats the same meals, and from this incredibly circumscribed life extracts a kind of cosmic melancholy that's also somehow life-affirming. He's Sisyphus with a desk job.
I want to circle back to something we touched on earlier, the political dimension. This taste profile has an implicit politics, and I think it's worth naming. Absurdist humanism, as we're defining it, is fundamentally skeptical of authority, but not revolutionary. It's not about overthrowing the system. It's about recognizing that the system is arbitrary and navigating it with a combination of humor, curiosity, and human connection. It's conservative in the sense that it doesn't believe in utopian solutions. The absurdity is permanent. It's part of the human condition, but it's anti-authoritarian in the sense that it refuses to take power seriously.
That's well put. It's the politics of the raised eyebrow rather than the raised fist. The warts we're discussing aren't calls to action. They're invitations to perspective. They're saying, the people in charge are as confused as you are, the rules are made up, and the appropriate response is to be kind and curious and to laugh at the situation.
Which is why the Trump era was such a fascinating stress test for this sensibility. Here was a figure who was himself an absurdist performance, the deadpan delivery of impossible propositions to see how the system would react. The difference is that Nathan Fielder's propositions were harmless, and Trump's weren't. But the mechanism was eerily similar.
The mechanism of watching society try to process something that shouldn't be happening. The gap between the statement and the normal social scripts for responding to statements. That's the comedy mechanism, and it was operating in politics in a way that wasn't always funny, but it was sometimes. That's the uncomfortable truth. The absurdist sensibility doesn't switch off just because the stakes are high. If anything, it becomes more relevant.
All right, let me try to consolidate. We've named the genre absurdist humanism. We've identified its core features: impossible or surreal premises presented straight, emotional warmth, and romanticism. Skepticism toward authority without revolutionary fervor. Comedy that comes from recognition rather than cruelty. And a resistance to tidy closure. And we've built out a cross-media canon.
Let's list the recommendations explicitly, since the prompt asked for them. Film and TV, Charlie Kaufman's entire filmography, especially Synecdoche, New York, and Being John Malkovich. The Truman Show, The Purple Rose of Cairo. How To, with John Wilson. Welcome to Night Vale.
Literature, Borges, Calvino, George Saunders, Fernando Pessoa, Gogol, early Murakami. Theater, Tom Stoppard, especially Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, Our Dead and Arcadia. Philosophy, Camus, The Myth of Sisyphus, Baudrillard's Simulacra and Simulation, Richard Rorty. Art, Sophie Calais.
I'd add one more film that we haven't mentioned, Being There with Peter Sellers. A simple gardener who's lived his entire life in a townhouse is thrust into high society, and his banal observations about gardening are interpreted as profound political metaphors. He becomes a presidential advisor. He's completely genuine and completely empty, and the world projects genius onto him. It's the absurdist humanist political comedy par excellence.
Being There is an incredible call, and it ends with the famous shot of him walking on water, which is either a miracle, or a metaphor, or a joke, and the film refuses to tell you which. That's the refusal of closure in its purest form.
I think we've done what the prompt asked. We've named the thing, and we've built the canon. And the canon is richer than I expected when we started. Absurdist humanism turns out to be a pretty robust tradition. It's not just a niche taste, it's a major current in 20th and 21st century culture. It just doesn't get named as such very often.
Because it falls between categories. It's not quite comedy, not quite philosophy, not quite drama, not quite sci-fi. It's the work that genre taxonomies can't capture. Which is appropriate, given that it's work about the failure of systems to capture reality.
The genre that resists genre. The category that undermines categories.
Meta to the last.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the 1943 eruption of Mount Taberver in Papua New Guinea, volcanic gases rich in sulfur dioxide and hydrogen sulfide reacted in the atmosphere to produce traces of vanadium pentoxide, which condensed as a brilliant orange-red crystalline dust that local residents initially mistook for a synthetic pigment spill.
A synthetic pigment spill from a volcano. That's one way to rebrand natural disasters.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. And if you enjoyed this one, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your
head. Send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.